This recording is a production of Faith Builders Resource Group. This recording was made at Reach 2022, a conservative Anabaptist ministry convention hosted by Faith Builders Educational Programs on March 24 and 25, 2022, in Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
All right, welcome everyone. We're going to get started here. Looks like you've all conquered the labyrinth of halls and stairwells. You found yourself here. We are here at session brought to us by Caleb Kreider titled Your Readers Matter, Serve Your Audience by Improving Your Writing. Caleb comes to us from Strasburg, Virginia, where he works at Christian Light Publications. His work involves publishing new books and marketing products. And I understand that he has authored two books. So we look forward to hearing from him today about ways in which we can improve our writing. With that, I'll turn the time over to Caleb.
Well, good morning. It is great to actually see you. As I was preparing this talk, I tried to picture you, and I couldn't do it. So I want to practice what I preach, and I'm going to preach today that you need to write with your readers in mind. And wanted to do that as I was preparing this, and I wanted to know, what kind of writing do you do, and who do you write to, and what do you already know about writing? And I didn't really know any of those things, and so I found it a little difficult to get going. And we'll see how wide of the mark or close to the mark I am by the time we're done. So I wanted to tell you too that the lens through which I approach this is not the lens of a story writer. Like, I use snippets of story in my writing, but I'm not a story writer, so not everything I say today applies to writing stories. So hopefully, I just wanted to make that clear. I'm sure none of you write like President Warren Harding, whose speeches were described as an army of pompous phrases moving across the landscape in search of an idea. Here are two quotes about writing that I like, and I can identify with these, and maybe you can too. Writing is the art of applying the seat of the pants to the seat of the chair. And this one: as the best-selling author of 5 books, I can tell you without hesitation that the hardest part of any writer's job is sitting down to do the work. And there's truth to both of those statements. So what we're going to do today, I have 3 main sections in this presentation. The first point is write with your readers in mind. And then number 2, make your writing a 2-step process. Write, then revise. And then lastly, we're going to look at some simple ways you can cut clutter and polish, sharpen your writing, and that'll be interactive with some interaction there. So on the front of your handout is a picture of a sign, airport sign. This is from LaGuardia Airport in New York City. And the sign reads, the headline or the title is, "Terminal Closed for Maintenance Between 12 a.m. and 4 a.m. until further notice. Ticketed passengers and employees only," all caps, "will have access to terminal." So I know we're just getting started here, but from the perspective of writing to make things easy and clear for readers, what might be wrong with this sign?
Reading.
You stopped reading it?
It was closed.
Yes. It's confusing because from the title or the headline at the top, it looks like this terminal is closed. I need to stop and turn around. I'm not allowed here. All right. Anything else that comes to your mind?
I was just trying to think, who else other than ticketed passengers and employees would even need access to the terminal?
Right.
So it's open.
Normally, I'm not sure what the setup was, but maybe visitors could come in, but normally they let passengers and employees into terminals. Mostly that's it. Anything else?
Well, AM versus PM, 12 AM might be confusing to some people.
Yes.
It might be more clear, I don't know.
I agree with you. If to say midnight, so 12 AM, for someone like me who's not real, I don't know, I'm not usually up at that time of the night. I have to think twice. What's 12 a.m. and what's 12 p.m.? So just say midnight. Midnight is more clear.
The phrase "until further notice" is confusing.
Yes. The phrase "until further notice" is not needed. As long as the sign is up, the message applies. And if the sign's not there, it doesn't apply. So you don't need "until further notice." Anything else?
The ticketed passengers and employees only will have access. Is that all the time or only between 12 and 4? So it's confusing as to what they're actually saying.
Yep.
Is there such a thing as an unticketed passenger?
Well, it depends which part of the airport you're in. Yes, so you all did a great job of identifying the issues. The tone is a little bit, I don't know, not the nicest, especially the all caps there. And one other thing is the employees probably know this already, so it might not be needed for them. So anyway, that sign could be rewritten in just a much more clear way for harried passengers in an airport to quickly get it, get the message, and adapt their behavior accordingly. So the person who wrote this probably was not trying to be confusing. They just weren't thinking. Someone just like typed something up, put it on the sign, and went on. But that's why we need to put ourselves in the reader's shoes as best that we can. Knowing who your readers are allows you to adapt your content, your illustrations, your supportive arguments to match the average reader. And so I'm taking it as a given that you know who you're writing for and who's going to read your writing, or you have a good idea. So if you don't know, then I'm trying to find out. So the first step under ways to write with readers in mind is to picture a specific reader in your mind. So pick someone that you know will read this and write as if you were writing to them. And maybe that doesn't apply in your situation, but in my situation often it does, where I know someone, I'm acquainted with someone that's going to read what I'm writing. And so I write to them as I write, and it helps me be more clear. What will this person think? Will this person understand what I'm saying? And you can do that with multiple people, okay? But try to picture at least a specific reader in your mind. Or you can take that further and do several specific readers or age groups or whatever. Then understand what the different segments or groups are within your audience. So there would be different age groups, different church groups, different worldviews. So even within our Anabaptist circles, which we're kind of all the same, right? But we're all kind of very different too. And there's very different worldviews, somewhat different worldviews, even within our Anabaptist circles. And that affects how you approach things sometimes. At Christian Light, we have many non-Anabaptists in our customer base because they buy homeschool curriculum from us. And so if I'm writing something that will go out to all of our customers, you know, I will consider that as far as what I say or how I say it. Because they don't look at things quite the same way. They don't have the same backgrounds I have. Then three, consider what is the audience's reading level. And this can vary based on who's reading, who's going to be reading your work. This relates to your word choices, the length of your sentences, how complicated your sentence structure is. So I'll read you a sentence here, and this one is kind of a higher reading level. This came from the Faith Builders newsletter. Much human misery and disillusionment comes from expecting fullness of life to come from possessions, human achievements, marriage, exotic experiences, or even particular religious experiences. It's a fine sentence. If you saw it in print, you could pretty easily understand what it is, but it's for a higher reading level than if it was a shorter sentence with not so many big words like human achievements, exotic experiences, disillusionment. Consider how much the reader already knows about this topic. And so here, I don't know you. I don't know what you already know or what your frame of reference is for writing. And so, you know, I hazard telling you something you already know, and which I don't like to do that. But when we're communicating with people, we usually overestimate what they know. Because we are so steeped in our subject matter, that we're thinking about our work or our organization, our content, every day. And our readers are not. They're thinking about it like 1 minute every month. And so we have to remember that. Someone in your audience, if you are putting out a newsletter, for example, there's a couple of things to consider. One is they may be a regular reader of your newsletter, and you think, okay, I covered that last time, and so I'm not going to mention it this time. I'm going to assume everyone remembers, but they won't, because your newsletter is very important to you, and it's top of mind and everything, but for them, they read it when they were half asleep on a Sunday afternoon one time, and they don't remember a thing. So you have to remember that. Also, there are new readers coming on all the time, depending on your situation. And so you have to remember that and kind of cover some of the early foundations periodically. And don't assume that everyone knows what you're talking about. A lot of readers may not be familiar with the terms or the programs or the jargon that you're used to using. So you have to simplify that, explain it. And then consider how the reader is likely to respond to this that I'm writing. This maybe doesn't apply to everything, but are they going to be skeptical of this? Are they going to be receptive, hostile, supportive? What objections are they going to have? And if you identify some objections that someone might have, you can go ahead and address that in your writing. Answer the questions in advance. The biggest reason most of us write unclearly is that we don't know when readers will think we are unclear, much less why. Our own writing always seems clearer to us than to our readers because we read into it what we want them to get out of it. And so, instead of revising our writing to meet their needs, we send it off the moment it meets ours. That was a quote from the book Style, The Basics of Clarity and Grace. If you want to do further research to this phenomenon, there's a term for it, the curse of knowledge, sometimes called the curse of expertise. And it happens when we forget what it's like not to know something. So a teacher knows way more than the student, right? And they have to remember what it's like not to know what that is so they can walk the student through the steps to learning it. And it's the same way in communicating as we have to, in writing, is we have to meet the audience where they're at. And I see this happen a lot in like prayer meeting at church. Someone says, let's pray for George. And so maybe 75% of the people heard about George. He had an accident or whatever. But there's a few people that are like, I don't know what you're talking about. So that's not writing, but it's the same thing. From Wikipedia, the curse of knowledge is a cognitive bias that occurs when an individual who is communicating with other individuals assumes they have the background knowledge to understand. For example, in a classroom setting, teachers have difficulty because they cannot put themselves in the position of a student. A knowledgeable professor may no longer remember the difficulties that a young student encounters when learning a new subject. So do you have any questions about anything that covered so far before we move on to another point? Or comments, questions or comments, either one. Okay. So number two then, my second point is to make writing a two-step process, which is you write something and then it is revised. So some people, when it comes to writing the first draft, some people are, and I do this, write, backspace, 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 and I'm like writing and revising the whole way through. And other people are more like brain dump, and then they come like through and fix it. And I don't care which way you do it, either way is fine with me. But the point that I want you to remember is that writing is a different type of mental exercise than revising is. When you're writing, it's creative production where you're creating something out of nothing, sort of. Where revising is it's a more of an analytical process where you're working with something that already exists on the page. So I've read that writing and revising happen on different sides of the brain. Quote, when you try to write and edit at the same time, you're setting up two sides of your brain in a duel. Rather than getting these two sides to support one another, you're putting them into a competition that neither wins. So my suggestion is to separate writing and revision into two steps. Write it and lay it aside for, it could be an hour, it could be a week, a month, whatever, and then come back and visit it again because you'll see things you didn't see the first time. And you also need someone else to review your writing, but before that happens, you should go through it twice, two different steps yourself to polish it up, take it to the next level. Revising, quote, is part of writing. Few writers are so expert that they can produce what they are after on the first try. Quite often, you will discover on examining the completed work that there are serious flaws in the arrangement of the material calling for transposition. Remember, it is no sign of weakness or defeat that your manuscript ends up in need of major surgery. This is a common occurrence in all writing and among the best writers. It's a quote from Elements of Style. So I mentioned that someone else should always review your writing. And as an organization, if you're in an organization, you probably have a process for that, and that's important. But having someone else look at it is the best way to see what's confusing, what's not clear. They can tell you. So I ran across this phrase in a sentence in an advertisement a few months ago, and I don't know what it means. Do you? To grow and compensate minds in a network of creativity. So I know you don't know the context, but to grow and compensate minds in a network of creativity. Anyway, I don't know what that means. As someone was using words, I didn't know what they meant, what it meant. So my point is there with that is that having somebody else look over that and give suggestions would help that person get their point across. I often have my wife read articles that I write, and she will tell me, like, this doesn't come across very nice, or you missed a word here, or whatever. And I appreciate that. In my book, Getting Along at Work, my sister read it, and she pointed out that I use triplets a lot. It's like a set of three separated by commas. So I wrote, communication is like lubricating oil that keeps a workplace healthy, productive, and efficient. So there you have the triplet at the end, healthy, productive, efficient. And she said, oh no, the quote continues, sorry. Communication is like lubricating oil that keeps a workplace healthy, productive, and efficient. Imagine an engine with no oil. Without communication, work slows down, mistakes happen, frustration grows. And my sister said, this starts to feel a bit repetitive, monotonous, and stale. So, yeah, we all have things that we do like that, that other people can help. So even if you don't have, like, an official editor to cover your work, have at least somebody with a little bit of skill, another set of eyes to read over it, and that will help. Okay, any questions or comments about that?
Do you have any tips or tricks for, like, separating yourself from what you just wrote, because a lot of times you write something and you're not aware of your own, like, idiosyncrasy of writing, like the triplets thing you just mentioned. Like, do you have any ways of, like, being able to see, you know, what you just wrote that might stick out to someone else?
Yeah. Well, it's hard to see it in your own writing until someone else tells you, and then you can identify it the next time more easily.
I think reading it out loud to yourself helps you pick up on things. If you don't, especially if you don't have somebody else who can read it for you, if you sit there and read it out loud, it sounds a lot different.
You're right. Good suggestion. And Word. Has a read aloud feature that will read it aloud in a computer-ish type of voice too.
I was going to mention that. I've been using that. There is something very different about hearing something being read aloud.
Yes. And if you miss a word, you'll pick it up then as well. Anything else?
Just a basic Word program.
Like Microsoft Word?
Yeah.
Yeah, in the newer editions anyway. We'll move on now to practicing cutting clutter. Who do you suppose said this famous author? So the writer who breeds more words than he needs is making a chore for the reader who reads. So the writer who breeds more words than he needs is making a chore for the reader who reads. It is Dr. Seuss. So I don't know how many of you remember when Alan Greenspan was the chairman of the Federal Reserve in the 90s, probably early 2000s. And he had developed an art form of speaking in very vague, obscure language. And so he actually said, when a congressman asks you a question, like in testimony before Congress, and I don't want to say no comment or I won't answer or something like that, I proceed with four or five sentences which get increasingly obscure. The congressman thinks I answered the question and goes on to the next one. And let me give you one of his quotes. And he's talking about how, like, the people get excited and the stock market goes up and down. Such developments apparently reflect not only market dynamics, but also the all too evident alternating and infectious bouts of human euphoria and distress and the instability they engender. Here's another one. I know you think you understand what you thought I said, but I'm not sure you realize that what you heard is not what I meant. That's a beautiful sentence. So, well, I have a mental editor's checklist of being accurate. That's a no-brainer, but accurate, brief, and clear. ABC, right? Accurate, brief, and clear. And so what we're talking about in this section is mostly brief. You can make your reader's job easier by cleaning up your writing and keeping it condensed. I included a copy of Churchill's memo to his war cabinet in 1940. This was at the beginning of World War II, and the British government was very busy with mountains of paperwork, no emails, being hauled back and forth between departments. And Churchill said, I ask my colleagues and their staffs to see to it that their reports are shorter. The aim should be reports which set out the main points in a series of short, crisp paragraphs. If a report relies on the detailed analysis of some complicated factors or on statistics, these should be set out in an appendix. Often the occasion is best met by submitting not a full-dress report, but aide-memoire, consisting of headings only, which can be expanded orally if needed. Let us have an end of such phrases as these. It is also of importance to bear in mind the following considerations, or consideration should be given to the possibility of carrying into effect. Most of these woolly phrases are mere padding, which can be left out altogether or replaced by a single word. Let us not shrink from using the short expressive phrase, even if it is conversational. And then I like his last sentence, talking about But the saving in time will be great, while the discipline of setting out the real points concisely will prove an aid to clearer thinking. So I support that 100%. So then I picked 7 things you can do to help declutter your writing. And these are not the only 7, or maybe, and not even the best 7. It's just ones I thought would be helpful and easy to process. So use action verbs instead of being verbs. When possible, being verbs are words like am, is, are, was, were, be, being, been. Example sentence, he is, being verb, very generous in his profitable business, allows him to do this. So let's rewrite that to get rid of the is and use an action verb. His profitable business allows him to give generously. The world is constantly pressuring us to conform to his values. We can use the action verb pressures. The world constantly pressures us to conform to its values. Moving on, use the word of less often. So the desk of the secretary's desk. The love of God, God's love. 3, delete words that mean little or nothing. Words like literally, actually, basically, honestly, obviously, rather, very, little, pretty. So I use basically a lot in my emails, kind of like we basically whatever, and so I use it to kind of as a qualifier so that I don't come across quite so. It'll give me a little wiggle room, but I shouldn't. But that's different than, you know, something that's going to be printed and published. 4, delete words that repeat the meaning of other words. So 2 well-built, robust officers, we could just say 2 well-built officers. We don't need to go over and beyond the call of duty. We can just go beyond the call of duty. Delete, 5, words implied by other words. Readers can often infer information that does not need to be stated. In this example, that the person climbed the tree. So the original was, she had climbed up a tree and fallen to the ground. We could say, she had fallen out of a tree, because we know that she climbed it. She got up there. Having someone in your home with you, we could just say, having someone in your home. Instead of a terrible tragedy, we could just say, it's a tragedy, because a tragedy is, by definition, is terrible. It's the same way with these other examples. Basic fundamentals, just choose one word. Future plans, every plan is future, just to say a plan. Exceptionally outstanding, same thing. That's a very easy way to knock out a few words out of your writing. And then replace a phrase with a word. Confession can restore relationships that have experienced a rift. So we could say, confession can restore rifted relationships. So that doesn't sound right. So we'll say, confession can restore broken relationships. And we get rid of that whole phrase, that have experienced. Bishop Robert is a well-respected leader in his church. We could just say he's a respected church leader. That one actually changes the meaning just slightly, so you have to make sure that it matches your original intent. Then there's 7, there's something called nominalizations, which are words that used to be verbs or adjectives, and now they were changed to nouns by adding onto the end of them endings like ing, t-i-o-n, s-i-o-n, e-n-c, and so on. So you can, if you use less of those words, you will reduce the reading level of your writing and make it easier to understand and more active. So reduction becomes reduce, interference becomes interfere, acknowledgement becomes acknowledge, refusal becomes refuse, and you tell me now, reach a decision becomes
decide.
Make a suggestion.
Yes.
It was an encouragement.
Encouraged.
It encouraged. Provide a warning against.
Warn.
Success is dependent on. Success depends on. Yep, excellent. Okay, so before we run through these examples, what questions or comments might you have about what we covered so far? Is something not clear, or you want to add a comment or suggestion?
You said reduce.
Go ahead.
You said reduce things like just last 7.
Yes.
That it makes it a lesser, lower the reading level. And is that a good thing? Always.
In my opinion, yes. Yeah, I mean, even if you're writing to adults, they make it easy for them to read.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, comment and then a question, and with your suggestions for making things more concise. Like, I agree, this is usually very helpful. My experience is there's sometimes that the less concise version is what you want because it can be more emphatic or emphasize a particular point. But that only works if you generally make them concise, and it's the exception rather than the rule.
Good point.
The question is the stylistic part, and if that comes more as an editor, but I get a lot of reports coming from frontline workers on the field that need edited before they're going to go out somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And I do all these kinds of things to them, make them shorter, especially if they're going out on WhatsApp or something like that. But I get people pushing back a little bit, worry about it a little bit myself, is that it loses the style and flavor. All of a sudden, it feels like something hooked up in the PR office rather than something from the field. I don't know. Or if you have comments on the style, perceived authenticity, and that kind of thing.
You heard the question. Do any of you have anything you'd like to say for that? To that?
I'm an editor, and I fear that I've stripped the personality out of a piece of writing. I'll often pop it back to the author and ask if they can approve of that. If they can't, be free with their criticisms and suggest that they fix what they think I broke.
So he will send it back and ask them for approval, and if they don't like something, they can fix it. Excellent.
I do editing for, we transcribe seminar topics and turn them into readable forms, because transcription is pretty hard to read. So we come across that a lot. I do the same thing. I have to be careful not to remove the personality of the person. So I can do a lot of this stuff, but still have some of the quirky little saying that they might put in there, or a phrase that's their kind of phrase. Even though I might like to clean it up, I'll leave that in there, but yet still clean up a lot of the rest of it. And that kind of helps give them a little bit of their personality, leave it in there.
If you're editing someone else's writing and you leave in a few little things that show their personality, that helps.
Some of that might depend if the person's name is attached to the writing, whether or not it's, there needs to be that sensitivity, whether it's coming on behalf of an organization or something like that, then it can be adjusted. Although it is a very sensitive thing to use a sharp sword on someone's writing. But I think constantly assuring people that changes in writing, as you had listed here, is not evidence of a terrible job done. It's just behind every good writer is a good editor.
Yeah. So it needs to be a training process for those of you that are editors to convey to the writer not to take these edits personally, and to help them see that you are on their side, helping them communicate better to the reader. And if the writer can understand that you're actually helping, making it more likely that the reader will appreciate the piece and it's to their benefit that you edit it, then that helps them accept it more easily. But coming from Christian Light, where we edit everything, like, to me, it is I accept edits to my own work. I don't really accept it. I expect it, and I want someone else to edit my work. But you have to grow in learning to accept it. It's part of being a writer is having someone edit your work. So, anything else?
I think if the editor goes with the attitude, I want to make this better for them, make them sound better, I think that helps. I think it's really important not to change something that I don't agree with, like a doctrine or position.
Yeah.
That's, I don't think that's right. But,
Yeah, don't insert yourself too much into changing their points or whatever. And actually, it's true that an editor can mess up a writer's work. That's true. I acknowledge that. And so sometimes a writer has reason to be upset. So that happens, too.
There is, I think there is such a thing as an editor feeling like they need to earn their keep, so there's no such thing as responding and saying, looks good.
Yeah, that, it, for those of you that are editors, you know, if a piece comes in and it's pretty good, just say, hey, this is pretty good, and you know, fix a couple things and let it go. It save your time and save the other, save the writer. You don't have to justify your job by editing something that doesn't need to be edited. Excellent point.
Something maybe for the editors to consider is, years ago I wrote for a Christian publication under different editors, and some of the editors did not make a lot of changes because they liked my style of writing, but other editors changed more things because they liked a different style of writing. So sometimes maybe for the editors, maybe we need to consider whether we're just changing this for us because we like this style, or we're really trying to help. What's our real reason behind it?
Right. Writing is subjective. Every writer personality comes through, or it's very personal, and actually editing varies similarly based on who the editor is and what their skill and expertise, where their skill and expertise lies in their personal preferences and so on. So it's a good, needs to be a good balance and kind of develop a partnership, hopefully, with the person that you're working with.
Maybe one just last comment.
Sure.
Like the suggestions. The one thing I think about sounds nebulous, but editing with love, and I don't just mean for the person, but even for the piece of work. And so it can be easy to go in there and just start kind of editing mechanically, and okay, some stuff is pretty mechanical, you can just go in there, but have I really paid attention and gotten the feel, kind of the feel and the heart of what they're trying to write before I start editing?
Yep. Thank you. So let's spend our remaining time. We will practice cutting clutter, and I have 50 little snippets of phrases or sentences here, and each of these can be condensed a little bit or reworded a little differently to improve it. And you won't, you may not have time, may not necessarily have time to write all this down on some of them, but you're welcome to. So I'm going to read the phrase as it's printed, and then you are going to tell me, you can just call out, you don't have to raise your hand, you can just call out how you would fix that little piece. So number one, these verses from the Bible remind us. These Bible verses remind us, or these verses remind us. Because in most contexts, we know the verses come from the Bible, I don't have to say it. I have some thoughts.
I think.
Number three, a regularly scheduled event.
A regular event.
A regular event.
Just an event.
An event.
Annual event.
An annual event. In the year 2022. In 2022. In the country of?
This year.
In the country of Canada.
In Canada.
One person I spoke with told me.
One person told me.
Or someone told me. Eventually, it came to a point where I realized.
Eventually, I realized.
For the purpose of advancing God's kingdom.
That God's kingdom may be advanced.
To advance God's kingdom. He had very positive feelings toward her.
He liked her.
By the way, I pulled all of these, I believe, out of things that I have edited in the past. So these are real life examples. When he did his studying,
when he studied,
reject the use of violence.
Reject
violence or violent methods. The experience of being raised in a...
Being raised in a whatever.
The united teamwork.
Teamwork,
or you could say the united efforts, depending on what you how you wanted to say it. I was fearful, number 14, of what would happen.
I feared. I was afraid.
Good. Okay. in number 15, in light of all the needs there are in the world. In light of world needs, or just delete there are. So in light of all the needs in the world, there is, those words can usually be the sentence can be restructured. You can take those out.
Considering world needs.
16, it is essential we follow Jesus.
We must
follow Jesus. I talked to an individual who owns a woodworking business. I talked to a woodworker or the owner of a woodworking business. Number 18, but I want to suggest that God intended. You can just take out the but I want to. Contentment cannot be attained by the acquisition of material things. Change acquisition to acquiring. Or another word, if you want. The economic and spiritual needs of people. People's economic and spiritual needs. Number 21. My wife and I have not bought a new car in all our years of marriage.
My wife and I have never bought a new car.
Number 22. While the common conception of a missionary is...
Not quite.
Sorry. So I would say we usually think of a missionary as. While these books contain some nuggets of truth that may be helpful, what could you delete from that sentence?
Some helpful truths.
While these books contain some helpful truths, yep, something down that line. I'm going to skip a few here just because we're running out of time. We're going to wrap up in 5 minutes. Okay, 27. This is a hard one. Some unwelcome thoughts that come to mind can hit us at unexpected times and be persistent. I hate sentences like that. So here's one way to do it, number 27. Unwelcome thoughts can be both unexpected and persistent. And here's an editing tip for you. If you can't figure out what the author means or you can't figure out how to say it in another way, just delete the sentence and go on. That works sometimes. Number 33, he has not been sufficiently cognizant of... He didn't know. He wasn't aware. He didn't understand. Number 35, have you ever had thoughts rise up in your mind that you would be embarrassed to see if they popped up on a screen for public viewing? So that one we could delete, rise up in your mind that, because thoughts are going to be in your mind, right? So we don't need to say that. So have you ever had thoughts that you would be embarrassed to see if they popped up on a screen? Number 37, the Apostle Paul is saying that he had learned to be content.
The Apostle Paul was content,
or Paul had learned to be content. Good. 38, God's sustaining grace saw us through. God's grace sustained us. 41, take heed and be aware of the fact that your strength may cause discord in the team. We could just say, be aware that your strength may cause discord in the team. Number 46, their daily prayer support was a constant source of encouragement in our lives. Their support encouraged us, or something down that line. Number 50, a number of years ago, I was sitting in a church service listening to a sermon on the ideal family life. We could change that to, I once heard a sermon on the ideal family life. Because we don't need to know a couple years ago. We don't need to know you were sitting in church. Because if it's a sermon, it's probably where you were. So I listed a couple resources there for further learning. The last one, style, the basics of clarity and grace, is the best. It's also, or, I mean, it's it's thorough and it's more advanced. So if you're advanced, go for that one. If you're less advanced, go for the other one. Another quick tip is keep your paragraphs shorter, especially if your work is going to be published in two-column format. Those columns get narrow than you're working with on your computer screen probably, and then that stretches out the column length. People like to have short paragraphs because it breaks up the text more. Use subheadings for the same reason, kind of breaks things up visually. So I am going to take any questions or comments that you have in about 30 seconds. Yes?
So I think you may have talked about this somewhat, but I'd like to hear your thoughts on it.
Okay.
So what is the place of style? Is the goal of an editor to make it more standard and less stylistically specific? What does it look like for an author to have his own specific style?
How much should an editor affect the style of an author? And if it's going to, it just depends on the context. So if it's going to be published by the organization in your newsletter or something, it should be somewhat consistent across the newsletter because you want it to be professional and whatever and don't want to be too stylistically rambunctious or informal or whatever. But if it's the author's book, their article, you want to lean more towards keeping their style.
Thank you for listening. All recordings from Reach 2022 are available from Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. To purchase additional recordings from Reach or other Faith Builders events, visit us online at www.christianlearning.org or call us at 814-789-4769.